I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We start the program today with a memory. 50 years ago today, a few minutes after midnight, civil rights activist Medgar Evers was gunned down in his driveway in Jackson, Mississippi, by a white segregationist who wanted to stop Evers' work as a field organizer for the NAACP. He was just 37 years old, a war veteran, a husband, and a father of three. Evers had put his life on the line to register voters. Here he is a month before his murder.
Demonstration will continue. We will have a mass meeting tonight, and after the mass meeting, we will be demonstrating even further on tomorrow. So then this will only give us an impetus to move ahead rather than to slow down. We intend to completely eradicate Jim Crow here in Jackson, Mississippi.
Medgar Evers' death was a tragedy, but also a turning point in this country's long battle for equal opportunity and justice. At his side at the end, as throughout, was his wife, Merle. Merle went on to raise the children left fatherless by his death, fought to see her husband's killer brought to justice, and became a significant leader in her own right as chair of the NAACP in the 1990s. You might also remember she delivered the invocation at President Barack Obama's second inauguration earlier this year. Merle Evers Williams and her family are in Jackson today to commemorate Medgar Evers' death and life, and she's with us now. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us at such a busy time.
Oh, it's indeed my pleasure.
How is it for you to recall these events? It can't be easy.
No, it is not. And let me say this, that the events stay with you regardless of the year or the time they are there. You work through them, you suppress them, you put them away, and now here I am, surprisingly so to me, reliving all of these things. And it's good because people remember young people who did not know about that period of time are very curious about it. And I certainly have worked very hard over these years to be sure that Medgar was remembered. I really am surprised that I'm beginning to feel a little emotional about it, because I have fought emotion and replaced emotion with doing things that were positive to help people remember Medgar and others whose names we don't use that often or recall that often. So it's kind of strange. It really is.
We talked after President Obama was first elected. You mentioned that you still had with you the poll tax receipt that your husband had in his pocket with his blood on it.
That's true. I do.
And I wondered, did you ever feel kind of caught between wanting to remember so that others will remember and wanting to forget yourself?
Never wanting to forget, but working hard to be sure that others remembered. Medgar gave so freely of himself, and for many years, his name was very seldom, if ever, mentioned with other civil rights leaders. I found that an unbearable pain, because he was one of the first and gave so freely and who wanted nothing for himself in all of this. It was just that his beliefs were that deep. And I was determined to be sure that in some way, positive way, or ways, that Medgar would be remembered. And after 50 years of working and securing justice in his murder, building my own careers and taking care of my children and whatnot, life has just been busy. And in the background was this knowing thing of you've got to do more, and you've got to do more to be sure that this man is remembered. So here we are at this day and time, and I feel relieved that people in America and around the world, for that matter, know who Medgar Evers is.
One reason, though, you had to keep working was that it took a very long time for his killer to be brought to justice. I mean, the man who
30
shot him,
years.
Byron De La Beckwith, he was an avowed white supremacist. He was tried, but the jury deadlocked. And then 30 years later, after a new investigation, he was finally found guilty. I wonder, did you believe that day would come?
I knew it would. It had to. I had promised Medgar just a couple of nights or so before he was killed that if anything happened to him and I survived, I would be sure that justice would be served. And I don't make many promises, nor do I break them. And it became a passion of mine. So how do you juggle the needs of entering the past and moving through the future while you live as normal a life as you possibly can by rearing three children? It's not easy, but I have been blessed to have friends, you know, my children, supporters here and there. So I don't know. A psychiatrist might say I have a split personality.
Yes.
But whatever, it has worked to serve my needs, and I believe the needs of America as a whole.
What has it taken for you to emerge whole from this? I mean, there are a lot of people who suffer a loss who never get over it. And I know that you said that, you know, it's always with you. But one of the things that I think people admire about you is that you did go on to have a full life. I mean, you ran for Congress yourself. You had a career. You finished your education. You raised your children. As we said, you remarried.
That was healthy.
Yeah. What can people draw from your own experience, you think, of how you learned to recover from this?
Well, it's basically accepting the fact that life does go on. And it is left up to each individual as to what kind of life you have. I'm not one to give up easily. And I know Medgar would have wanted me to pursue those things that I did, and he often told me that I was stronger than I thought I was. So, you know, there you are. I don't believe in sitting in a corner and being, oh, woe is me. You get up, and you find challenges, and you move forward, and that's what I've done with my life, and I'm very blessed to have been able to do that.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Merle Evers Williams. She's the widow of the slain civil rights leader, Medgar Evers. He was killed outside their home in Mississippi 50 years ago today. Voting rights was such a significant part of Mr. Evers' life and work, and also your life and work. There is a major case before the Supreme Court relating to voting rights. And one of the main questions in this case is whether certain areas of the country still should have federal oversight. I don't know whether you have an opinion about this, but if you do, I would be interested to know.
The answer is yes. I will be upfront about that. There are, yes, certain places in this country, but why are we being specific about certain ones when we find prejudice and racism at the polls anywhere you look in this country? Other states will deny that, but if you look at the subtlety of it now, the subtlety of ways of keeping people from registering and voting, it's no longer how many bubbles in a bar of soap or how many peas in a jar. It's more subtle in the sense that you have to have certain IDs now, that you have to have certain clearances, to even keeping people waiting for hours in the line to vote. And that is not the way it should be in America.
Do you remember this? He was speaking at an NAACP gathering about a week before he died, and he was quoted as saying, "I love my children and I love my wife, and I would die and die gladly if that would make a better life for them." It's kind of chilling to hear those words. I don't remember if he ever said that to you, you know, directly, but in the years since,
yes,
though.
Yes, he did. Yeah, yes, he did.
Did you
times.
Feel that his sacrifice was worth it? Really, all of your sacrifice, because all of you had to live with the loss.
Yes, so. Yes, I do. I do feel that. I did not initially. I think I did, but I could not accept it at the time that he was alive. But looking back, Medgar felt so strongly about justice and equality and the role that he could play. And he knew that his life was on the line, and he still continued to do that. I did not always support it, but I came to support his needs, his wishes. I'm just pleased and proud to have known him, to have been his wife and the mother of his children. So I ask for strength, I ask for blessings, and I have been fortunate. I've received both.
You mentioned earlier there have been a number of tributes to mark this important moment. I'll just play a short clip of President Clinton speaking at Arlington National Cemetery last week where your husband is buried.
Medgar Evers just came home from the war and said, "Hey, I want to vote." I want to have a say in the affairs of my community. I want all people to be treated like they're the same, and it turns out that we are.
Of all of the tributes that have been planned and are being delivered in memory of your husband, is there anyone in particular that's particularly meaningful to you?
Yes, and it's a very private one. Our youngest son, Van, was at Arlington Cemetery, and there was a private gathering at Metka's gravesite. And he became a little emotional, but he looked at me and he embraced me and he said, "Mom, that was my dad." That moved me more than anything else. But to have President Clinton, all of these other people, Mississippi from around the world, all of these wonderful things that are happening are just so rewarding to me. To fly into Jackson, Mississippi, to the Jackson Metcalfe Evers Airport, is so important. To have young people discuss him and determine what they can do based on Medgar's life. The beat goes on, as they say, and I'm so pleased to have been a part in seeing that happen.
Merle Evers Williams is the former chair of the NAACP. She is, as we know, the widow of civil rights leader Medgar Evers. He was killed 50 years ago today, and we found her in Jackson, Mississippi, where she is attending many commemorative events. Merle Evers Williams, thank you so much for speaking with us. Thank you for your own work.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, warmer weather often means that women like to take off a layer or two to beat the heat, but too many then read that as an invitation to critique.
He kept saying things like, "Don't worry, I don't bite. Why aren't you going to talk to me? I can bite if you want to."
Our beauty shop ladies talk about the growing movement to stop street harassers. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. You might have checked out some of the duds the NBA superstars are sporting off the court. One of the people who helps them stay that fresh is designer Oswald Boateng. We'll hear how the son of Ghanaian immigrants found his place on London's prestigious Savile Row. That conversation is just ahead. But first, we want to take a trip to the beauty shop. That's where our panel of women writers, journalists, thinkers, and activists talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. And today, we want to talk about something that a lot of women and some men have to deal with, especially now that the weather is warming up and there are more people on the street. We're talking about the whistles, the calling out, the unsolicited comments about one's attire. You know what we mean. For generations, women have been told to ignore it or enjoy it, that it's ultimately flattering. But now many women are saying, no, it's not flattering and it's not harmless. It's actually verbal abuse and it needs to be stopped. Here to talk about this are Tracy Clayton. She's a writer and blogger at BrokeyMcPoverty.com and TheRoot.com. She's with us from Louisville, Kentucky. Holly Curl is the founder of the nonprofit group Stop Street Harassment. She's also author of the book Stop Street Harassment, Making Public Places Safe and Welcoming for Women. Here in Washington, D.C., with me is Jasmine Garst, producer and co-host of NPR's Alt Latino, and Viviana Hurtado, blogger in chief of the Wise Latina Club. Welcome, ladies. Welcome back, I should say.
Hi, Michelle. That's a nice dress you have on.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mommy. So I want to mention, we reached out on Facebook to ask listeners about their experiences and opinions about this. I have to tell you, it took about an hour to get hundreds of emails and more than 1,000 Facebook comments. I just want to play a clip, and from women and men, I do want to say, from women and men. I just want to start with a clip from a woman named Rochelle Cahan. She lives in Philadelphia. She's the director of a group there called Hollaback that is also aimed at ending what they call street harassment. Here it is.
One instance where I was taking the subway home from law school, and someone was already on the subway when I got on with his two friends, and they were like just making comments at me the entire time, pointing and laughing. And then when I got off the subway, one of them followed me, and he kept saying things like, "Don't worry, I don't bite. Why aren't you going to talk to me?" I can bite if you want to, and just like really annoying. But he was following me also. So it was like crossing the line from annoying to, oh my God. I just walked straight to the police station, and when he realized where I was going, he stopped following me. That was pretty scary.
So let me ask each of you, does this represent like the outer edge of experiences, or does this actually feel kind of like a normal day? Jasmine, what about you?
Well, I think there's a little bit of both. You know, I think there's guys who say, hi, how are you doing? Or you're looking nice today, which I actually don't have a problem with that. I think that's a beautiful human interaction. But then there's the guys that make you feel embarrassed, humiliated, or just it's just very aggressive. And that's the line that is crossed that I think makes people very uncomfortable.
Vivian, what about you?
I live in the U Street area of Washington, D.C., and so it's every single day that something like this happens. But it is in perception. And for example, I've had somebody walk next to me and say on the street, baby, you look as good as you smell. So he got close enough, and I guess I'm glad I hadn't just worked out. But then just yesterday when I was walking my dog, I had somebody whistle and say, hey, shorts. There was a very big difference for me between a guy who was dapper and he was in a business suit and he said, you smell, you know, as good as you look. And then somebody who just didn't even acknowledge that I was anything more than short. So that goes to perception as well and intention.
I don't know that I want anybody smelling me that I don't know. I'm just saying, I'm just throwing that out there. I don't know. Tracy, what about you?
Well, I definitely agree wholeheartedly, that it's about perception, because once you have enough of those experiences that do cross the line, you know, people following you down the street, people actually putting their hands on you, then, you know, when that happens enough times, then someone who approaches you probably with very good intentions to say that they like your hair today or you look very nice, you know, your guard is already up because you don't know where it's going to go after that, because unfortunately, I think there's this paranoia among women that after you get that compliment, then it's going to go somewhere else and someone expects something from you. So, I mean, for me, it doesn't matter which happens more often because I kind of prepare for the worst anyway.
Holly, what about you?
For me, interactions on the street need to be gender neutral and not commenting on how I look for it to be a compliment to me. I think that our culture is very much focused on telling women and girls from a young age that our value is in how we look, and to have that reinforced on the streets by men commenting on how we look, whether it's positive or negative, I think is really damaging and is not the kind of message that I think young girls and women should experience. You know, in the research that I've done, street harassment starts really young. Of more than 800 women, almost one in four were experiencing harassment by age 12. And so I think that's really, really problematic.
So you're saying that if somebody says to you, if you were walking your dog and somebody said, your dog is cute, and you realize that person would say that to a man as well as a woman, or I like your dog, or your dog is friendly, or I like your briefcase, right? Then you feel like that's an acceptable interaction. But if it's something that you think you would not say to a man, that's what kind of is the line, Holly?
Yeah, for me that is, and I can give an example. So I'm a runner, and so I experience so much harassment when I'm out running. And a few times, you know, people have said things like, oh, you're looking strong, or, you know, you have a really strong stride. And both women and men have said that. And I felt like that's a compliment because that's about my achievement and me as an athlete. But when people comment on, someone said to me, I like the way your tits bounce when you run, you know, that's clearly very offensive and not something that I want to hear. Or when I'm running and I hear whistles and honks, 10 times in an hour. That's very annoying. That's very disrespectful. And men don't have to deal with that at that kind of level.
Yep. And I don't think people in carpool want to hear that word either. Holly, thank you. I understand your point. Appreciate it. But to your point, Holly, just one more thing just to tie a bow on this. Your view is that you feel like this kind of boundary crossing sets women up. It's almost like it's training them to accept their boundaries being breached, right? That you should learn, you should accept being spoken to in a certain way. You see what I'm saying? Is that what you're saying? You think it's kind of like cultural conditioning that that you are required to listen to this kind of stuff and you have to take it, that sort of thing.
And I think that men are taught that women want to hear that. And so some of the scary harassment really happens when maybe a man says something to a woman or a girl and she ignores him or just doesn't give him the response that he thinks he deserves. And then he gets angry and says, well, you're not all that anyway. Or I guess I won't say any of the other terms.
Yeah,
that's
not.
They would
but
say,
we kind of get
you know, or would follow them. Or, you know, I've heard so many stories from women who have men chase them or throw trash at them.
Well, in fact, Tracy, you had an experience like that of somebody who tried to drop a book on you because you wouldn't return from like five stories up because you wouldn't respond to his entreaties or whatever they were. If you're just joining us, we're having our Beauty Shop Roundtable with writer Tracy Clayton, journalist Jasmine Garst, writer Viviana Hurtado, and activist Holly Curl. We're talking about what many activists now consider street harassment, the calling out to people on the street, particularly women. But now I just want to give another perspective on this. This is a clip from a woman we heard from named Kristen Sargent, and this is her perspective. Here it is.
When I'm complimented in the street, that doesn't bother me. I wouldn't consider that harassment. Recently, I was traveling in New Orleans, and after a hot day of sightseeing, I wasn't feeling my best. I stepped off a curb, and I almost got run over by a guy on a bike. My response was to jump back, smile, and excuse myself as he swerved. His response was, "Girl, give me that smile again." I couldn't help myself. I laughed. I had almost been run over, and yet the whole situation was so pleasant.
Now, Kristen says she shared the story on another social media site, and she got a lot of people who were mad at her, saying that she lacked self-esteem and that she was enabling street harassers. So, Vivian, I want to get your perspective on this. What do you think?
Well, it's something that Jasmine and I were actually talking about right before we walked in, because both Jasmine and I are Latin American. I was born here to Latin American immigrants. Jasmine is Argentinian. And at least culturally speaking, in Latin America, there is the relationship between men and women is different. Mm-hmm. Not to say that machismo culture is 100% clean of its issues. It's not. And not to say that harassment and rape culture does not exist. It does. But at least there is a dynamic that's different. I think we need to talk about power when we're thinking about the relationship between men and women. And I grew up in a household where women embrace their femininity and where it is very common for men, whether it was my dad, whether it was my brother, whether it were my uncles, my male cousins, to compliment a woman. It was seen as something that is no different than if I were to return it to a man. Well, you look very nice today, too. So I do think that, again, going back to what I was saying, what is the intention of a man? Is the intention of a man to say, you look nice and that's it? Or is it ...
No. Tracy, what do you think?
Well, in my personal experience, it almost always is ... And I think that in my conversations with men, a lot of them don't understand how a woman could get upset at somebody telling them that they look nice today or to ask them to smile. And my answer to that is, you know, you don't know what kind of day somebody's having, you know, and also it's my face. If I don't want to smile at you, that should be okay. And there's also this idea that a woman who is not in the mood to respond to a man in the way that she wants, she's a misandrist. She is, she has no home training, as we like to say, down here in the South. And I think there's definitely this dynamic of there must be something wrong with you if you don't like this sort of attention.
Holly, what do you think about this? Does it matter what the intention of the person is making the remarks? Does it matter what the age of the person is? Like, for example, if the person is close in age to the person he or she's talking to, what do you think?
Yeah, just from my research, that definitely makes a big difference. So if there's a big age gap, that can make something that the same statement seem very creepy and scary to someone than if it is said by someone around the same age. So yeah, context does play a big role.
But what about the issue that these ladies have surfaced here, the cultural issue? Do you buy that if people come from a culture where they feel like, well, people talk to women on the street and that's okay? Is that okay? Holly?
Yeah, I think that's a really hard question. You know, street harassment, I think at its core is when people aren't able to give consent to an interaction. So I think that as long as someone does feel like they're able to give consent, then that's fine. And again, just me personally, I feel like that the imbalance where it's mostly men saying things mostly to women, I feel like that contributes to, you know, rape culture and gender inequality. But You know, on a more general level, I think as long as consent is given and taken and the interaction ends when both people want it to end, then that's fine.
I have another comment that I wanted to read from a woman named Kutsia Jafri, and she is a Muslim American woman. She lives in Maryland, and she wrote to us to say, catcalling and such is often associated with short hemlines and cleavage, and ultimately something a woman, quote unquote, must have asked for by calling attention to herself by showing skin. You won't see a lot of Muslim women or women of faith in general walking around showing a lot of skin, but you can bet that we have to deal with the same sort of street harassment as any other woman, and unquote, Jasmine. So she's saying, look, I don't think it has to do with what you're wearing, or it's not complimentary. It really is a power interaction. That's what I heard from her comment. What do you think?
Well, I think, yeah, I've been catcalled in some pretty horrible sweatpants. So, but I think there is definitely a power element, and I really do believe that there's it's context, like Viviana said. I mean, there's a cultural thing, and I do think there is a difference between someone saying you look nice and someone saying something that is absolutely a power thing, absolutely trying to get off on making you feel either insecure or unsafe.
So what should we do about this? I mean, let's just talk about the kinds of interactions that people find unwelcome. I mean, this for so long we've all been told that you have to ignore it, learn to live with it, or drive everywhere, you know, roll up your windows, you know, don't walk, that sort of thing. So let's talk about it. Have you found, are there effective strategies for addressing things that you find are unwelcome, that you don't like? Viviana?
I think it depends on the context. If you feel that you're in danger, I think getting in somebody's face and saying, why are you saying this to me? How dare you speak in this tone to me? Could be dangerous. So I think you have to think about context. I recently had a situation where, again, I was walking my dog and a kid came up to me, probably 17 or 18 years old. I just thought he was going to ask me the time. And he signaled down to his privates. And then he walked away. And he walked into a building that belongs to an institution. So what I did was I walked straight into that building and demanded to speak with the security guard. And then I filed a police complaint. I was able to do that. Now, look, if I was walking my dog and I'm passing by an alley and somebody says something and there's a possibility that I could be dragged into that alley, I don't know if I'm going to say something. I think I might just keep going and get away and to safety as soon as possible.
Yes.
To me, also, when somebody says something that could be interpreted as harmless, like, hello, good morning, you look nice, I make sure to answer really assertively, thank you, or good morning to you, you look nice as well. So that I'm just not establishing myself in this position of I'm so scared and I'm so vulnerable. I make it an adult conversation.
Holly, what about you? You've spent a lot of time thinking about this, obviously.
Yeah, I think that, as everyone's saying, the context really matters, and a lot of times harassers interact with you in a way where they definitely have the upper hand, and it can be very scary. So I think that everyone needs to keep safety in mind. But when you do feel safe, often having some sort of response that surprises them can be so effective because it stuns them, it stops this interaction, and hopefully it makes them think twice about harassing someone else.
Like what? Give an example.
Sure. So repeating loudly what they've said if there's people around or asking them to repeat themselves. Something that's worked for me is just saying, don't harass me or don't harass women. And that seems so straightforward, but every guy that I've said that to has been really surprised and sort of dumbfounded that I've, you know, named what they are doing and I said, don't do it.
Tracy, what about you?
Well, I think that I have a bit of a process where I have to kind of steel myself before I leave my apartment. And, you know, I've got my headphones in place, hoping that if somebody sees me walking down the street with headphones, they won't say anything. I have a very, very vicious, mean look that I will pull out when the headphones don't work. And usually neither of those things work. But as it was said
worth
earlier,
a shot,
it, you know, I give it my best shot every time. But it really does matter the situation that these encounters are happening in. If I'm in a dark alley and there's a big scary man talking to me, you know, I'm not going to choose that time to say, hey, mister, you know, this is wrong. But I have actually had some times where I've had discussions with men who, with the best of intentions, I'm assuming, have stepped to me. And I would just be like, you know what, guy, I'm not really in the mood for it today. You know what? Or I would ask, you know, what kind of response were you expecting? Okay, here's why you're not going to get this response. And please think about that next time. But I mean, generally, I just try to, you know, just press through it and get to where it is that I'm going.
Talking helps them. All right. Well, thank you all so much for talking about it here, even though I know it's not the easiest subject to talk about. So thank you all so much. Holly Carl is the author of Stop Street Harassment, Making Public Places Safe and Welcoming for Women. She joined us by phone from New Orleans. Tracy Clayton is a writer and blogger with us from Louisville Public Media in Kentucky. Here in our Washington, D.C. studios, Viviana Hurtado, blogger-in-chief at the Wise Latina Club, and Jasmine Garz, producer and co-host of NPR's Alt Latino. Ladies, thank you all so much.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Just ahead, Oswald Boateng is as famous for his own personal style as he is for dressing Hollywood royalty. We'll find out what the statesman of cool wears to his own interviews. That's coming up next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Later in the program, I have my latest essay. I've been thinking about how we know what we know about people and why that matters. But first, the NBA Finals are in full swing, and while the on-court matchup between San Antonio and Miami is heating up, you might have noticed that the off-the-court sartorial competition between the players is as hot as ever. And while a league rule requiring better off-the-court attire is one reason for the change, another could be the influence of a man we're about to meet. Oswald Boateng was the youngest and the first black tailor to have a shop on the prestigious Savile Row, a street in London that's famous for its fine tailoring. He's known for dressing Hollywood as well as athletic royalty. Actor Lawrence Fishburne has said that when you wear an Oswald Boateng suit, you become a statesman of cool. But he's also a statesman for something else, the future development of Africa. And Oswald Boateng is with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I think when people hear of men in fashion, men have been in fashion forever, but they're always interested to figure out how they got interested in not just wearing clothes or designing clothes, but making them.
Yeah. I mean, my story is quite simple. Usually men blame women for everything in their lives, be it good or sometimes not so good. In my particular case, I fell in love in college with this really amazing girl who could paint and draw with both hands. And she's the reason why I design clothes. She basically pointed me in the direction to discovering my talent. So I was 16 years old, and that's it. So basically, love is the reason why I design clothes.
Were you always kind of secretly interested and didn't have an outlet for it? I mean, were you always a boy who liked to dress, for example?
No, I was. But I think that's also my mother's fault. You know, I had my first suit made when I was about 5 years old, bespoke suit. So I had come accustomed to the importance of style, and my mother used to take me to church, and, you know, we had to dress our best for that. As well as my father was a teacher, and he always wore suits and always looked smart. And so it was almost a way of life in my household to look good.
Now, you were born in England, but your parents were born in Ghana, correct?
That's right, absolutely.
And so I think many people who grow up in Africa are used to having clothes custom made.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And so was that part of the tradition in your household as well, that was just an ordinary thing? Because I think a lot of Americans think of custom made clothing as really being quite extraordinary. I mean, it's something that is familiar to a very, very small slice of society now in this country.
You know, the suit represents many things, you know, and I think for my father in particular, you know, in Ghana, it meant respectability, it meant authority. And so to look smart in the suit was almost cultural. Plus, you know, the suit, it has such a relationship with English traditions. And Ghana, where I originate from, was colonized by the Brits. So through colonialism, you had almost the Ghanaians being more traditional than the British themselves. And the suit was a very important part of that.
Well, Savile Row, speaking of which, is the ultimate expression of the kind of British establishment, British style. When you started making clothes, did you always have your eye on Savile Row?
The reason why I chose to set up shop on Savile Row was mainly because I was about 18 years old and I identified that there was a kind of something missing from the traditional suit on Savile Row that was made. So I realized that there was an opportunity to combine fashion design with traditional tailoring. I knew how to make a suit, but I didn't know how to make bespoke suits, but I had a real flair for design. And so I realized that if I could marry those two worlds together, I could really have quite a dramatic effect on menswear globally. And so that's what I set out to do. What was interesting, though, is when I kind of discovered Savile Row, the concept of the traditional suit had become so old-fashioned and was so out of sync with what men wanted, it was clear that there was a real opportunity. So I took it.
How would you describe an Oswald Boateng suit for someone who has not yet experienced it? And this will either be a very pleasing question to you or just a terrible one. Because it's almost describing like why you're handsome. I mean, that's...
No. Well, I think the way to define it, and it's evolved over time, you know. When I first started designing suits, it was always about enhancing the wearer's form and making him be very attractive to women. So in the same way a man responds to a woman in a dress that's very flattering to her form or wearing high-heeled shoes, I took that same principle and I put it onto men.
Do you think that men mainly dress for women?
I think actually, I think it's both. I think men dress for women, definitely. But also, they dress for themselves if they understand what they're wearing makes them feel better about themselves. I mean, the big thing for men is confidence. And so I like to believe that what I create enables men to be more confident about who they are.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with British designer and bespoke tailor Oswald Boateng. Before we move on to some of the other work that you're doing, I did want to ask whether you've ever designed for President Obama, who's known to look pretty good in a suit.
Yeah. Well, I have. He came over to Ghana, and the president of Ghana, we presented a suit and a mourning suit on the behalf of the Ghanaian people to him. It was his first visit to Africa when he became president, which was phenomenal for Ghana.
Have you seen him in it?
Mm-hmm. I wish he wore mine. I wish, but you would have known it if he was wearing mine, I can tell
really,
you.
Really, I was going to say, how would we have known it was yours?
No, it's from the shoulder line. It would have been a very flattering form around his body. So you would have visibly looked at him and seen a much sharper line. For sure, you would have noticed.
Talk a little bit more, if you would, about the other side of your life. You've been talking a lot more about the importance of development in Africa, business and business ties,
and
doing your part there. Could you talk a little bit more about what you're trying to do there?
Well, for me, it's quite simple. The big issue in Africa is its lack of infrastructure and its lack of connectivity. So if you're originating from Ghana, if you're in Nigeria, there's not even a decent road or rail connection between the two countries. And the impact of having that connectivity or rail infrastructure is enormous in terms of what it does to trade. And so my feeling is really that, connecting Africa with its infrastructure is the key way of changing the poverty position on the continent.
You can certainly see in a field like yours where getting goods to market is the critical piece. I mean, the workmanship can be whatever it is, but if people can't get their goods to market, then
Exactly. And more importantly, but you've got to remember, if you don't have the infrastructure or the refinery to refine your own natural resources, then you're never getting true value for the value of your asset. And so this is one of the things that Africa suffers from. You know, it controls probably 60% of all the known minerals on the planet. But yet, you still see Africa as being poor, and it doesn't make any sense. So the foundation I set up is called Made in Africa Foundation, and basically it's about unlocking that potential. How we've done it on a very practical level is we identified that one of the issues of unlocking those potential is no one's ready to put the first dollar into the feasibility plan or the master planning of any project, be it an urban development, road or rail. And so the foundation has made it their objective to finance that first dollar. So we believe that raising $400 million to be spent on master planning and feasibility studies for infrastructure will create $100 billion of projects across the continent. And that would effectively create about $1 trillion of value. And that will add another 2% of GDP onto the continent, and lift about 200 million people out of poverty. So the formula is not a complex formula, but it always seems complex when you put Africa against it. You know, infrastructure plans or investing in infrastructure in any developed country is a norm. I mean, they're investing $250 billion in Russia on high-speed rail and similar amounts in China. You know, we need the same in Africa.
Sounds as though your interests have moved a little beyond fashion. I'm just wondering whether you consider getting into public service yourself.
No, it's funny. Someone always asks me the question, so how did you get into this passionate place on infrastructure? And it's, you know, it's quite simple. I just want to open shops back home. I get asked the question all the time, but there's the surroundings that I require to have my own store, let's say in Accra, requires me to build the environment for many stores to have the one store. So once you're at that place, then you start to say, you look at the fundamentals and you ask yourself, what's stopping that from happening? And then you realize that to do that, you need to do the right master plan and right feasibility planning for it to come off the ground. And then you realize once you get to that point, you realize the overall problem. So I kind of was taken on a journey to this. I love creating clothes and designing. But one thing as a designer, what we get taught, and you learn that very early on, is your ability to look at cloth and imagining what it can be. It's like every single designer is taught that, and it's a part of their being. So once they can visualize what it can become, then suddenly then their guns are blazing. And so that's effectively what's happened with me in regards to Africa. It started off with just looking at a plot of land and saying, what can I make it? And then it grew from there.
Sounds like public service.
No. I'm a designer. I will always be a designer.
Okay, well, we'll check back with you. When I come back, check back with you. Remember, we had this conversation. Well, speaking of which, you know, President Obama is set to visit Africa later this month. He's set to go to Senegal, South Africa, and Tanzania, recognizing that you're staying in your lane for now.
Yeah.
Just wondered if you had some advice or hope for the president when he's obviously no stranger to the continent, but is there something in particular you wish he'd focus on?
I actually have got some advice for him, actually. I think I've got a really good piece of advice. I think Africa has always been very excited about Obama. I mean, you know, he just demonstrated the possibility, and he allowed many Africans to dream. So bearing that in mind, and bearing in mind that he goes to Africa with carrying that lantern of promise, he needs to use that. And I think what he needs to do is I think he needs to engage in Africa really unlocking its potential. I think he should invest in Africa in infrastructure the same way the Chinese are doing. And he needs to be more involved. And I actually think that if he can get Africa to a place where it's a proper partner for the world, I think the world would be in a much better place. So if we get it right in Africa, we get it right for everybody.
And he should wear your suit.
Of course. I wanted to wear my suit. Could you put that in for me, tip? So that suit that I gave you
suit.
A few years back, could you wear that suit when you come to Africa? Could we do that?
Could we do that, please? We want to
see
the suit.
Yeah, I mean, that would be, that would be the ultimate treat.
Exactly. Oswald Boateng is a designer. He's the founder of the Made in Africa Foundation, and he was kind enough to join us from the BBC studios in London. Oswald Boateng, thank you so much for speaking with
us.
I hope we'll speak again.
Absolutely.
Finally, today I was thinking about one of those heartbreaking lessons you must learn if you are to survive as a journalist, which is there are many, many people who do not care what's true. No matter how many times you tell some people that President Obama is not a Muslim or that there are actually many more white people benefiting from food stamps than blacks or Latinos, there are people who just can't wait to tell you why you're wrong because, well, they know a guy who said the opposite and they like his story better. So it's always interesting to me to see the reaction when new information emerges that contradicts what a lot of people think they know. We actually brought you two stories like that recently. One, a poll of the attitudes of African Americans on a number of issues. The other, a study looking at poverty among LGBT folk. On the first study conducted by NPR, the Harvard School of Public Health, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, there were a lot of interesting findings, including that African Americans who've been, as a group, so hard hit by recent economic forces remain very optimistic about their ability to attain the American dream, at least eventually. But the interpersonal stuff was what got a lot of attention, mainly the finding that single Black men were much more likely to say they were looking for a long-term relationship than were single Black women. 43% of the single men said they were, compared to 25% of the single women. Now, it won't shock you to know that this was shocking to a lot of people. If you've ever watched even one Black movie, then the Black male playa is a staple of the genre, as well as the sharp-edged, sassy, destined to be single forever but secretly looking for a man Black woman character. Now, is it any wonder that a lot of people just don't believe it? But I believe it. I believe it because there are many things we don't know about people, even people we see or work with or think we know, simply because we never bother to ask them who they are or what they want. And the desire to love and be loved is a basic one. So why wouldn't Black men desire it, just like other human beings? The other news came from the Williams Institute, which focuses on LGBT issues, and found that the poverty rate among gay couples, even white males who otherwise enjoy many socioeconomic advantages as a group, is higher than among straight couples. Again, a head-scratcher if you've been raised on a steady diet of gay tropes about celebrity interior designers and shopping buddies, but maybe not if you think about the psychic cost of remaining hidden, or thinking you have to, or not being able to access the kinds of support for your family that many straight people take for granted, like a grandma willing to babysit or a church home invested in keeping you together. That's just a long way of saying that the more we ask people who they are, who they want to be, what they really want, the better chance we have of actually finding out. But then we have to believe them when they tell us. It's not for nothing that people like Senator Rob Portman tell us they've changed their minds about LGBT rights because they know someone who's gay and that personal knowledge makes a difference. Similarly, a 2010 Pew Research poll found that 35% of Americans have a family member who's married to someone of a different race, which is probably both a cause and effect of the waning of many overt forms of bias. Still, this new research suggests that personal knowledge is not always knowledge, that just knowing a guy who thinks he knows something isn't enough. In a country this big and diverse, we need both facts and friends, and hopefully the wisdom to know the difference. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow. Thank you.